Hello, and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we have a very special guest. Simon Tolkien is here to talk about his new book, Orders from Berlin. It is the third in the trilogy, I think. We're going to discuss that with him. And he's here to talk about it. And it's out from Minotaur Books and all your bookstores. Hello.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to finally talk to you. After all my sicknesses, it was quite a bad New Year's Eve for me, but I'm feeling much better now. So thank you for your patience. Now,
no problem.
I didn't realize this was a trilogy at first. It's not really a trilogy.
It's the fact that there's three books which all feature the same character.
Right, so you didn't mean it for it to be a trilogy. It just happened to be three books.
You can read them entirely independently of each other, although, you know, they're consistent with each other.
Right.
I mean, it's not that he has a wife in one and he doesn't have one mysteriously in another. You know, they're internally consistent. The first two, The Inheritance and The King of Diamonds, is set basically in 1960.
Right.
With year of my birth is 1959, with a backstory into the Second World War. And this one is set in 1940. So the detective is an inspector in 1960, and he's just a green starting off detective constable in 1940.
It's fascinating. I like that. I like the fact that we see his beginnings, and you know
he's become worldly wise and cynical. And I like the fact
that he's bold and just does things on his own without asking any permission. He's kind of a rogue agent almost.
Yeah, he retains the stubbornness in the later books, but there's a certain world weariness that hasn't yet crept in.
Right.
He's more idealistic at this point.
And I like the fact that Churchill and Hitler in this book too. It's fascinating. I mean, you're big on history. I mean, you have a very big fascination with history.
Yeah, and that's what I did at Oxford, and I always really liked history when I grew up, and then I left it behind in order to fasten myself into the straitjacket of the law, and then I became a barrister, and so I was doing criminal law. And then that took me into writing, and I started writing courtroom dramas. And then I started writing courtroom dramas that were set back in the past, and now kind of the past has taken over from the law, so I've come full circle.
Right. Well, this Orders from Berlin is not really a courtroom drama.
No, not at all. I've left that now.
Yeah.
Goodbye to all that.
Oh, really? Oh, you're done with courtroom dramas?
I think so. Not necessarily with the law. You know, The Inheritance was about the death penalty.
Right.
And then there was a little bit of courtroom drama in the King of Diamonds, in the sense that he had to go through a trial transcript, the detective, and there was a clue left in the transcript. But this one has nothing to do with the law.
Right.
Just policemen and history and bombs and Hitler and Churchill, you know.
I really like the way you write. I really enjoy your writing because you're writing, when I'm reading your books, at least with Orders in Berlin, I find that I can't wait to see what's going to happen. You always have two things going. You seem to have two things going on at once in this book, and I like that. We get to go back to Hitler, and then we get to go see it from another angle.
Changing the point of view. Yeah. I like that. I like a third-person point of view rather than an eye character seeing everything.
Now, has that been done in all of your books so far?
Yeah. I've never had an eye, which, I don't know, I find that really kind of hamstringing.
Right.
Rather in the way in which courtroom drama became hamstringing after a while.
Right.
You know, I want to see it from lots of different points of view. It's always difficult, of course. I mean, not so much with this book, because as you've seen, you get to find out quite early on who the bad man is.
Right.
Previously, I've done more whodunits, but I find that difficult because, in a sense, the author can't reveal too much about his characters or give his characters too much depth because he's having to keep the reader guessing about who did it. Which, I don't have that so much with this one.
Right now,
you know who did it, but is he going to be able to do it?
Now, is King of Diamonds and The Inheritance, are they whodunits?
The King of Diamonds slightly less so, but The Inheritance is a straight whodunit, you know. Man found dead in a country house, who killed him?
Right.
Lots of possibilities. Least likely possibility is the person that the police have got shut up awaiting the hangman.
So you seem to like to change your tone with each book. I mean, change it to something different, which is really cool. I like to different things with each book.
Yeah, change period as well.
But I guess as a writer, you know, if you write the same things, the same types of books each time, you get tired of. You want something different. You want to write something that's fresh and new. And
well, I want you to say with this one, I mean, this is a big departure because and a challenge because, as you say, I've got Hitler and Churchill in there interacting with fictional characters. right, and you've got to make the reader believe that they are actually there in the room. And then I've also tried to set it within the great bombing of London, which is very, I've tried to make vivid and tried to make people feel a part of it, but that's more of a challenge. It's more interesting, but it's more of a challenge. But fortunately, an enormous amount of primary material, because the BBC in England went about 5-6 years ago, they went all around England and they got accounts written down and put on the internet of all the people who lived through different facets of the Second World War, in particular the bombing. And so that's an enormous treasure trove for somebody who's trying to bring it to life in fiction.
Right.
It's called The People's War.
Exactly, yeah. And there's also a scene in here with you describe a pilot who's trying to kill this woman and her kids, and I think, well, that's very harrowing.
Well, that's straight out of, you know, that's again something I found, you know, people hiding under benches.
It wasn't a good time. It was not
straight from the air. I mean, quite unbelievable.
Right, and even the murder scene in the building is very vivid, and it stays in your mind after you read it. You write very vivid scenes. I mean, obviously you come from a writing background. J.R.R. Tolkien was your grandfather.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of writing talent of your own, which is wonderful to see.
Yeah, I mean, I think that must be right. I mean, I didn't write for a very long time. I'm kind of, an encouragement to people who come to writing late in the sense that I didn't start it off until I was 40.
Why?
Well, I think it was probably inhibited by my grandfather, not his fault, but I mean, that's, right. I think part of his legacy is, that I don't feel able to write myself. I felt that I felt self-conscious about my writing, and I felt kind of sort of inner certainty that I couldn't write. And then I shook it off when I got to 40. I think I wanted to sort of carve out some identity of my own when the big Lord of the Rings, Peter Jackson films came along. And so I took to writing then. And I think, curiously, I'd been writing a daily diary for 10 years prior to that, just really because I thought I wanted to keep a diary. But I think what I was unconsciously doing was making myself comfortable with language. Because in order to write, you have to be comfortable with language. As soon as the language starts to become self-conscious, it's like an actor on a stage, you know. If they feel self-conscious, then you don't believe in the play anymore. So I had to get beyond that. I think that's a big, big task for any writer.
Was it difficult for you when you first read? I mean, your first book was called which one was?
My first book was called Final Witness.
Final Witness, yes. Although it was called.
Wasn't the first book I wrote, David?
No.
The first book I wrote was, you know, what I thought was going to be my masterpiece, which was basically, you know, about a lawyer whose son goes to a horrible Roman Catholic school in the middle of the English countryside. You know, very autobiographical. Good fiction is never autobiographical, I think. And I thought it was just wonderful. And it was just dreadful, because what I'd actually been doing is teaching myself how to write. We always have to have one novel where you kind of work it out. So I sent it off. Back in those days, you have to, you know, send off your big brown envelope with a international reply coupon. And then they all came back very politely saying, not for us, thank you. And, you know, then I had to gird myself up with a lot of determination and, you know, write another one. And then when I wrote another one, somebody said, well, write about what you know, which is a cliche, but it's an extremely good cliche. So I started off with courtroom drama because I was a barrister and I knew how that worked and I knew how the inside of courtrooms worked. And then people said that Final Witness got very good reviews. It came out about 10 years ago in the States, Random House. And then, but they said, you know, it doesn't feel like a contemporary novel, even though it was set in the contemporary world. And so the next book, I took myself back 40 years because it was more comfortable.
Right. And when you're comfortable writing, I mean,
better fit.
Yeah.
And so I keep going back in time.
Audition Blend is very detailed. I mean, it's 300 pages. It's not what you would call an overly long book, but it's a very interesting book, and it's, yeah, I love the detail in it. I love all the detail about the characters. I love the detail about Churchill and Hitler. I'm loving reading it.
Well, I want to have characters that have depth. I'm really committed to the idea of this, you know, of bridging this gap that there is between literary fiction, where the characters have depth, but not very much happens, and you just get kind of bored. And, you know, thrillers, where you turn the page, but the characters are kind of cardboard. And I want to try and write thrillers, you know, going back to what we were saying at the beginning, where you want to turn the page and keep finding out what happened, but you actually care about the characters, and, you know, the characters have depth, and their interaction is
And Ava. I mean, Ava's such a great character, and we don't want to see her get taken advantage of.
Yeah, I started this off, David. Well, thank you for that. But I started this off with my last book, The King of Diamonds, where this character, this policeman, has a wife, Vanessa, who is taken up with a person that the policeman Trey thinks is a murderer. And that was my first real attempt to write a book from a woman's point of view. And the woman's obviously very conflicted between her estranged husband and the new man she's taken up with. But in this book, it wasn't so much a romantic situation. It's about a woman who's stuck in a bad marriage and with a father who's completely constricted her, and then with a husband who thinks the woman's place is in the home. And I think this period of 1940 is interesting because all the men went off to war, and that left a real gap and possibility for women to be doing things that they never had before, from driving buses to manning anti-tank batteries and sending up barrage balloons. And she sees all that happening kind of outside her window, but she can't take advantage of it. And the book is really about her voyage into independence and having a life of her own. So I try and write now books from women's points of view as well.
And I like the fact that the doctor she's married to, you think, well, she's married to a doctor. How bad off can she be? But he's got some debts of his own. I mean, he's not.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's not a very likable character at all.
He seems like
a very opportunistic person. I mean,
absolutely. I mean, very constricting, and you know, she's really suffocated by the life she has with him.
And when you read a book, it's very important that the character, the nasty characters are nasty, and that you can hate them, and the likable characters are likable. So you see that difference, and you feel that you're rooting for the good guy.
You really do need to identify. I suppose the thing with villains, for want of a better word, is that they can be very bad people, but you have to make them credible by giving them motivations that people might believe in.
Right.
And I mean, I tried to do that with the villain in this book, in the sense that he has a brother who was shot for cowardice in the First World War, and so that gives him a motivation to be doing what he's doing. Even if we don't sympathize, we have to understand, because otherwise the villain isn't believable.
And that's an interesting part of the book, where he's reading his letters, his brother's diary, and we see the human part of this guy too. I mean, we see he's not all a horrible person.
Yeah, I like the diary as a device. I think that you can bring something completely new in with a diary, and it enabled me to, in quite a short space of time, make the First World War really visible. There's some background noise, David. Do you want me to try and see if I can eliminate it?
No, we're doing fine. I don't think it'll be a problem.
You can eliminate it afterwards. It's just a somber noise. I can control it if you need me to.
No, yeah, everything's fine. That's perfectly fine.
Okay.
But and that's why I like your books, because you're good with characters. The characters are the most important thing. If you don't like the characters, if I can't identify with the characters in a book, I'm going to close the book. I'm not going to read the book. I don't want cardboard characters. I don't want these. Now, I'm not going to mention any names, but there are certain writers that write thrillers, and they're good thrillers, but you don't feel like you know the characters. You don't feel like you know who.
The characters don't matter.
Yeah, they don't matter. They're not as important as the plot. The plot seems to be more important to the author, and while that's important too, the characters are ultra important.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we were talking about your writing style and the characters, how important the characters are to you.
Yeah.
When you start a book, do you start with the characters, or what do you start with?
I don't find. Maybe there are some people who they're just like wandering down the street and they get this great idea and it all like falls into place and it's all like that. What I do is I take something and then I, for instance, in this one, I took spies and then something else, and then you see whether you can put the two together, like rubbing two bits of clay together and seeing whether they fit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a very, very slow process, and there's quite a lot of trial and error. You come up with something, and then that doesn't feel right. And it's a kind of tense process, because if you start off with something and then you put quite a lot of work into the idea, and then it doesn't work, you've wasted a lot of time, and also you're not just back to square one, but you're kind of back further than that. So it's a kind of tense, difficult time of trying to put plot something, then I start to plot really, really carefully. Because these types of books are written in accordance with very, very tight plotting. And the analogy, my mother was a sculptress, and I was really struck that she would build an armature, which is like a skeleton, if you like, that the flesh is then put on. So I know exactly what is going to happen before I start writing. But the art is to make the plot synopsis, maybe 5, 6, 7 pages, such that it is not so detailed that the characters can't start to live as you write. And that's really a kind of balance to be done. But I don't see how it's possible to create suspense and really write a thriller in the full meaning of the word, and unless you've actually plotted it out really carefully before.
Right, exactly.
And so that's what I do. And I do find that the actual process of plotting, combined with the research, it's taking me longer than the actual writing. So Orders from Berlin might be a little over 2 years, but more than half of that is related to research, which is obviously greater in a case like this with a historical book set in the Blitz. But it's also in relation to plotting.
Yeah, I mean your scenes are just really riveting. I mean, I'd read them and I just get so engrossed in the book. And that's so important as a reader that we feel that when we pick up a book, we want to feel totally engrossed. We want to be totally interested in what's happening.
Yeah,
we don't want to be bored at all.
And I hope I don't.
No.
One reviewer has described the plot as ingenious and outrageous, but I hope that it's more ingenious than outrageous.
And you got one of your books was Kirkus thought was one of the best books of the year.
That's the King of Diamonds. I mean, that was nice. You know, I mean, Kirkus is quite tough on you. I mean, they don't care about pulling the, you know.
They don't beat around the bush. They tell you exactly what they think about a book.
If they feel it. So that was really nice. That was very encouraging.
I mean, when you put so much work into a book, you know, you want people to like it, obviously.
Yeah, but you have to develop, you know, quite a thick skin, you know. People say bad things. You got to get on with it, you know.
Do you think people expect like more of you because you're in a famous family?
I don't know. I mean, the big line for me. I mean, in a reality, the people who are going to like The Lord of the Rings, with few exceptions, if they are really into that kind of genre of book, fantasy book, they are not going to like books which are set squarely in the here and now or in recent modern history, if you see what I mean. So it's not a natural fit. So I don't think I appeal particularly to Tolkien readers. I'm fortunate in the sense that I always really liked The Lord of the Rings. In some ways, I mean, it's a big influence on me. I mean, like, it was a big influence on The King of Diamonds, which is a book about, you know, how people are enslaved by jewels, which obviously has echoes from The Lord of the Rings of a pretty obvious nature. But I don't think that I get too many readers who are going to be drawn into my book because they're Lord of the Rings readers.
That's true.
And it gives you name recognition. People go, will double check it and say, oh, that's interesting.
Right.
It also enables you to get publicity, which is the lifeblood of books. You know, you need to get out there and be able to talk about your book. Otherwise, it just sits on the shelf, or even worse, on the e-shelf. So that all helps.
Now, how many years were you a barrister?
Eight.
8 years.
And before that, we have a crazy system, David, in England. We have solicitors and we have barristers, and they are different facets of being an attorney. A solicitor basically prepares a case, and a barrister presents it, which is really a kind of a crazy system, and it's perpetuated because both sides of the legal profession want to preserve their they're very conservative and they want to preserve the situation. It's slowly being eaten away at, but I spent about equal time. I was 8 years as a solicitor, you know, preparing cases for trial, and then I thought, this is crazy, I'd like to actually present them. So then I switched over to becoming a barrister, where you get to wear the funny uniform with the wig and gown and all that.
Right. That's great. But did you know at that time, while you were a barrister, that you wanted to write? Did you know that eventually you would write?
No, as I say, I kept a diary, but I absolutely had no clue whatsoever. I mean, if anybody had asked me, I would have said, I can't write. So it was a really big change, you know, come, you know, 2000, 2001, when I reached my 40th birthday, we had the millennium, we had Jackson's movie. So it was a big change. would be, or 13 years ago, they would be pretty astonished.
Right.
Both at the fact of various aspects, I suppose, but the, you know, that I live in California, that I write, you know, all these things. Not what would anyone would have expected.
Right. It sounds to me like you just lacked a little bit of confidence.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think inhibition is the big word.
But you must be having a great time writing now. I mean, do you actually have fun when you're writing books? I mean, is it...
Yeah. What is not fun, David, is going back to what we were discussing before, which is finding ideas. I'm now back into that. With this sort of awful process, you know, somewhere in your mind is going, am I ever going to get another idea? It's not the same as writer's block. I don't suffer from writer's block at all because I, you know, I plan my books, I write them, I execute them, and I've got a lot of confidence in that I'm able to do that. It's coming up with an idea and thinking, is it going to be good? And then you know, well, I've done it four times before, so I'm going to be able to do it again. But, you know, you keep on, you know, twisting around and thinking.
You wonder, I mean, you take an author like Nora Roberts, who has written 200 books, and she never seems to run out of ideas.
Well, how does she do that? Do you think she has researchers like Alexandre Dumas used to have? You know, like the Count of Monte Cristo and stuff. He had people who would come and give him ideas.
She's got to have somebody helping her.
Hitchcock, you know, he created his screenplays from other stories. So I don't know. I mean, I can't imagine how you could come up with 200 books with good plots. I mean, it's just completely... Those must be the people, mustn't they, David? You just roll down the road with these sort of wonderful ideas just feeding down at them.
They seem to attach themselves to her. I mean, she just has a different idea for every book. And,
yeah, well, I can't imagine.
And
amazing.
The success level is astronomical. Yeah.
Mm.
But I wonder why one author is able to do that and another one, you know, only has five or six books. Or even Harper Lee, who only had one book. I mean, why...
I don't know.
Why do these things happen? I guess it's inspiration. I mean,
irrationally, I think I will come up with another idea. It'll take me a couple of months, but I'm saying it's a tortuous process. And one's haunted during the process of, you know, by this sense of where will it come from? What will it be?
I mean, can you even imagine writing three or four books a year? I mean, you can't. There's no way.
I mean, it'll take me about 2 years.
Because you have a painstaking process where and it's...
Which works.
Which works.
You've really got to do what works.
It really works well for you.
Bit,
what do you do when you're not writing? I mean, you have kids. I mean, what do you have? Hobbies? You have time to do things?
Yeah, I do actually. I really, really love. I don't know where you live, David, but I arrived in Santa Barbara, California, 4 years ago, and I really fell in love with it. I just absolutely love this place. I mean, it's got everything. So I take my dogs on the beach. I walk on the beach on most days, and then I'm fanatical about golf. So I practice golf and I play tennis. So I play tennis, golf, walk my dogs on the beach, and you know, while I'm doing all those kind of things, I'm trying to think about these ideas for these books. If you see what I mean? Then I got to.
Where do you find you get most of the inspiration for your books? I mean, are you out doing these things when the inspirations come, the ideas?
Yeah, I mean, I don't honestly get a great. I'm reading a lot of other books at the minute. I mean, I've been reading an enormous number of books recently, but you know, I'm not actually getting ideas from them. I think the reading process of reading different things keeps your mind bubbling over. I'm reading a book about Berlin in 1933 about the American ambassador over there, which is by Eric Larson, which is nonfiction.
Right.
I've read that new thriller about a marriage called Gone Girl, which is the...
Oh, that's a wonderful book. Yeah.
Yeah, very good. And I've just read The Alienist. Which,
another
you know,
good one.
Yeah, so I've been reading a lot of things, and I'm reading a Susan Hill book as well. So I think that during these sort of kind of fallow periods, it does help to sort of read a great deal.
Does that affect your writing, reading other things?
No, I can't read while I write. There's a large amount of reading that goes into the historical research, like all this from Berlin. There was a great deal of research in lots of different places. I mentioned the People's War, you know, with the BBC archive. But you know other things too. You've got to read biographies, and you've got to read straight history. You know, biographies of Churchill and Hitler. I spent a lot of time watching videos of Hitler. You know, and then travelling to research places. There are the cabinet war rooms, which are, you know, the exactly where Churchill's bunker was, where a lot of the government of England was done from under the Whitehall. So all that's preserved in London. So that was fascinating to go
So is the research the hardest part for you, do you think?
No, I enjoy that. I'm a kind of natural historian. And, you know, Gordon's from Berlin was wonderful because I could get so, you know, with the internet, you can just go straight in as a result of the BBC and YouTube and stuff, straight into the primary sources, which was wonderful for the Second World War. And they're not classified. I mean, the difficulty with if you start getting into too much spy stuff is you get into classified material as well, which is a problem.
Right. Yeah, there's so much out there now. It's at your fingertips. I mean, you can find things out so quickly now. It's amazing what the internet is. And also, Gone Girl, Gillian Flynn actually reviewed one of your books. I saw at one point. So I think she worked for Entertainment Weekly at one point. So she liked your books.
Well, that's a really nice thing to know. I think she's a great writer.
Yeah, she is. She's a stunning writer. So, is Inspector Trave coming back again? Will we see him again?
I think that it's a good thing for me to do. I mean, the dilemma for me now, I suppose, is do I write another historical book? I would really like to. Sometime I'd really like to write about the First World War. I have a backstory in this book, and we've referred to, you know, the diary from the First World War. I'd like to write a book which is set around now. I really enjoy watching Downton Abbey.
Oh, yeah.
That whole period, you know, between about 1910 and 1920 is very interesting to me. But if I do that, then I'm outside Trave's time. Trave really starts in 1940, and I can take him up somewhere into the 70s. So the question for me is, do I write another historical book, or do I write something which is a more straightforward police procedural, as a sort of, you know, alternating between the two? And as I say, I'm in this period now of trying to think about what's next.
Right.
And, you know, I'm kind of caught. I don't really know the answer. It's this kind of awkward period.
Well, one thing I do know is...
of anxiety, if you like.
Yeah, one thing I do know is you know what you're doing. I like the way you write, and I trust you to that whatever you write is going to be interesting. I just know
once I've got something, I'll go with it. But, you know,
and that's it. It's finding that thing, finding and latching
absolutely.
On and realizing that. I mean, how do you know when you have an idea that it's going to be a big enough idea that it can be a book, or how do you know that it's going to turn into a book?
Well, I was really proud of the idea plotting in relation to Orders from Berlin, because I took two things which I thought were going to be really incompatible, which is, I said to myself, what I'd really like to challenge myself is if I can come up with an idea which takes my policeman back to a time when he had the least possible influence when he was starting out. Basically, he's a detective constable in 1940. And yet, I want to make it about the fate of the world, because I was always fascinated by September 1940. So I want to make a situation where what this detective constable does or does not do is basically going to deal with a world fate issue. And that's how I came to the assassination of Churchill. Because Churchill is terribly important to that time of 1940, because he was keeping the morale of the British people going at a time when the odds were so heavily stacked against them after the fall of France and the disaster at Dunkirk, their army driven into the sea, being bombed day and night by the Germans, and an invasion force on the other side of the water. And so I wanted to take that time, that critical moment in history, the fall of 1940, just after the Battle of Britain, and then make it all depend on a green detective constable starting out. There's a line in the book, I don't know if you've come to it, where it says, where Trave says, and, you know, the fate of the world may depend on a green detective constable and a housewife from Battersea. And if the book works, the reader actually believes that to be true. And I feel that that's a success on my part, if I've been able to bring that about.
I'm fascinated just to hear you talk about it. I mean, and in fact, I'm reading it, and it's such a fascinating idea that these two plots can come together like this, and be so and believable. It's got to be believable, and it's very believable.
And I mean, fascination is such a curious concept to write about. I mean, the great magnum opus, if you like, is the work of Frederick Forsyth, you know, The Day of the Jackal.
Oh yeah,
and
yeah.
Encouragement to be taken from that. It's a very good book. Because we all know that the girl does not die, but it doesn't detract one iota from how much one wants to find out what happens, if you see what I mean. And that helped me enormously, because everyone knows at the end of my book, Churchill doesn't die. But, you know, nevertheless, you want to find out what's going to happen.
and how it's going to happen, and what, you know, are they going to try to kill him, and what, how's that going to play out, and what's going to happen, and what's going to stop it, you know? And it's like in the Titanic movie. We all knew that Titanic was going to sink, but it was fascinating to see.
We didn't know what was going to happen to Leonardo DiCaprio.
Exactly, and it's still a fascinating movie, and that's the work of somebody who knows what they're doing, just like you.
Great screenplay. That I think it's not got sufficient credit because it was such a popular film. This way in which it mixes the past and through the jewel and the old lady with the present day, I thought that was very well done.
Right, and sometimes when I watch movies and I see the hero and the villain clash finally. It's such a fascinating moment. I mean, you want to see that same way in the book, like with Hannibal Lecter and the villains like that.
Yeah, you want that satisfying moment.
You want that. I mean, and there's a scene in here with the bad guy and another guy where you think they're going to come to blows, and they almost come to blows, and it's fascinating. You're like, oh, good night.
I think it was important to have that confrontation in the book.
Yeah.
At some point.
It's just it's fascinating to read because you're like, well, oh. And then you realize what is or isn't going to happen, but the characters are so you find yourself, you know, you could just strangle the one guy, you know, and you feel this anger and this hatred of the character.
I'm glad. Then it's succeeding. You care.
I mean, I can't wait till they make a movie out of this. It'll be interesting to see.
Well, you know, that's the point, David. There's nothing you can do. It's luck, you know. It's so much of Hollywood, you know, is making franchise movies like The Hobbit, or you know, and you know, sure bets. You know, everyone knows, you know, after Lord of the Rings, that The Hobbit's going to be this great success, you know, kind of regardless. But so that means that, you know, somebody's got to take a risk on you. Orders from Berlin is more of a challenge as well because it requires bombs falling out of the sky and Hitler and Churchill and stuff. And so it's quite a big movie, but you know, it would be. I guess the thing that I haven't had yet, which is to have one of my books realized on screen, is, you know, the next big thing for me. And that would be something, obviously very good for the books, but it would be a really fun thing for me to see it done, if it was done well. I'd love that.
Would you rather see a movie than on TV?
No, I'd take anything. I'd take anything, David. I mean, you know, it's not quite beggars can be choosers, but I would really, some of them would be better as TV. I mean, I think The King of Diamonds might be better TV. I think The Orders from Berlin, and I think Final Witness and movies, I think King of Diamonds is more a sort of masterpiece theatre type of thing. But it's just a thrill for an author to actually see your book is something I think would be wonderful, and I really hope that'll happen to me one day.
You miss being a barrister at all?
No, I don't. I think it was super cool. It was just fantastic. It was terribly exciting.
Did you get burned out of it?
Quite so much, yeah. Very, very, very stressed because everything depends upon you, particularly if you're doing mainly defense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the judges are really tough. Jury doesn't say anything. They're hanging on your every word. And it's adversarial in its very nature. And, you know, people are bashing each other. And there's your client behind you, you know, and so much depends on it. And, you know, it's very, very, very stressful. And you've got to make decisions, which is very exciting. You have to make decisions one way or the other, whether you call your client, how you run your case, which matter. But I felt that after I'd done, you know, over 100 major trials, that I didn't need to do it anymore. I mean, I was ready for a new challenge. So I have that feeling that I'm incredibly glad I did it. And, you know, it was great. But, you know, I'm glad that I do what I do now.
It sounds like you knew you weren't going to do that for the rest of your life. You weren't going to be a barrister.
I didn't know at the time. You don't know at the time. As I, going back to something I said earlier, you just don't know how it's all going to turn out. I don't know if that's been the same with you, David, but I think that, particularly with America, you know, there's this sense that you can change, you can do something else, you can, you know, start anew, remake yourself over. I really like that about America.
And pursue what you really love.
Yeah.
And
England is much more channeled.
Yeah, and it's a wonder. That's what makes life so wonderful. You can decide to do something. It doesn't even matter how old you are. You can do it.
I love that.
And
America really, really blesses that.
Right, and I mean, read. I mean, I love to read. I can't go a day without reading. I don't know how you feel, but I love to just read, and the joy it brings me, I could never totally express to anybody.
No, I totally understand that, but I can't read and write. I find that doesn't work.
Right. A lot of writers have told me that they it's hard to do both. It interferes with their writing.
Yeah.
But do you hope to have another book in the next couple of years?
Oh yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, I'd like to try it. You know, because I think Audience in Berlin is a success. It's doing very well, both in the UK and the US.
That's because
so
it's well written.
I'd like to follow it up.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly in the UK, they put a lot into it, so I'd like to follow it up with something. And I'd like to probably try and have something that, you know, can come out in, well, it won't be this year, but sometime in 2014, whether it's summer or fall, something like that.
Are you happiest while you're writing?
I find it like no, I don't find it a particularly happy process. I actually really enjoy the plotting process, and I enjoy the historical research process. But I'm telescopic in the sense that I'm always thinking about getting to a point. And so each 10,000 words is like, I'm not just happy in the process of writing. I want to get to the point. And I have to, you know, consciously slow myself because I'm well aware. I mean, some people just carry on churning it out, you know, hour after hour after hour. I'm not like that. I can start, and then the most productive time tends to be the second and third hour. And after the third hour in a day, the writing deteriorates. And so I have to be quite careful of that.
And sounds
but I want to keep going forward. You see what I mean? Partly because I have a plot and I want to carry through. So I have to control myself and I have to take days off as well.
Right. You sound like you know exactly what you're doing.
I'm quite good at that. I think being a barrister really helps because you have to organize material and execute it. In a good way.
Yeah, it's not like Perry Mason, where Perry Mason always seemed to know what he was doing, you know?
Yeah.
He always seemed to have it. He always seemed to know
where. Organization and material.
I mean,
but I think it does pay off. I mean, I think what you're telling me, which is really makes me happy, you know, this idea of depth and detail and maintenance of suspense through at a constant level. I think this process of plotting and research actually brings that about.
I mean, there are just some authors, and you haven't, you definitely have it. They're just interesting to read. I mean, no matter what you read of theirs, it's just interesting stuff. And then there are other writers that I can't read. I'll get 20 pages in, and I'm bored already. I mean, that's just the way it is. I mean, some books are just too dry for me. But yours, Orders from Berlin, is just interesting from beginning to end. I mean, I haven't quite finished it yet, but I know it's going to be interesting as much as at the end as it was at the beginning.
Mm. And it ends with Hitler.
What's that?
It ends with Hitler.
Oh, really? Well, that makes it even more interesting.
He kind of bookends the book.
But, I mean, to keep a book interesting, I mean, and the more I read, the more I realize how really difficult it is for a writer. I mean, it isn't just sitting down and the words come out of your you just write the words. You have to think about every word you're writing.
And well, yeah, but if you start doing that, then you start to become self-conscious and it doesn't work.
Right, exactly.
Then you don't have flow, then you become, you know, precious and self-conscious and you've had it.
But, I mean, to think
The best sentences are the really short ones.
Do you think that you have a blank page and suddenly all these words come out and you're able to do that? I mean, it's remarkable to me that you're able to do that.
It helps if you've done it. If you've written four, you know you can write five.
Right.
Then the issue becomes more tense about whether we've got the right idea.
Well, does each book become more of a challenge then?
This book was more of a challenge because of the much greater level of historical research.
Right.
And I was nervous about having real characters, Reinhard Heydrich, Adolf Hitler, Winston Churchill, in the book, because it's a new challenge, because you've got to make them real in the same way in which you would make a fictional character real. But the way in which you're making them real has to tally with what they were actually really like. A great deal of that means that you have to trawl through eyewitness accounts of people who knew these people to get little tiny facets which make the people real, which wouldn't actually be in history books. You know, that Hitler slept on a park bench in 1910.
Right.
His love of architecture, his vegetarianism, the fact that he wore eyeglasses, his watercolors, his impatience with Eva Braun sunbathing, his enjoyment of Hollywood films and the projection room in Baptist Garden. These kind of things, you feel slightly immoral, particularly if you're dealing with a very evil person in actually following these through, but they are absolutely crucial to building up a picture that somebody says, yeah, I can see this person, and at the same time, he is Adolf Hitler.
Right.
So that was a challenge, and it was something I was slightly nervous about, but everyone seems to say that I brought it off, so I'm pleased about that.
You're up for the challenge, I think.
It's just bringing stuff to life historically, and this was a bigger historical challenge. I enjoyed it.
How old is Inspector Trave in this book?
He's about 30? I think he's born sometime around just before the First World War, because he remembers, as a child, a small child, things in the First World War. He remembers, for instance, going, because his father was a soldier in France, he remembers going to Brighton, which is on the coast, for the day, and hear the guns from the Western Front booming across the Channel.
Right.
So he's got those kind of memories. So I would say that he's been born around 1908, 1909. And later on, in 1959, he turned 50. He's in his early 50s at that point. And I have the scope for taking him through into the 1970s, I think, as well. I haven't done that.
Very interesting. Now, you have family members that were in the wars?
Yes, I do. I mean, the war's always been, Second World War was always very interesting to me. I mean, my father trained as a fighter pilot in South Africa. He never actually saw action. He was over there for 2 years. And then my uncle was, he was a rear gunner in planes bombing over Germany. It was a horrible thing to be, because if you're going to be in a bomber, the last place, the most lonely place is in the rear. And my other uncle won the Military Cross on the Rhine after D-Day. So, you know, I heard stories from them. You know, my uncle who won the Military Cross, he described to me, I can remember sitting out in my mother's garden and him describing to me, standing in eastern France and looking down from his position and seeing a French peasant who was, cycling along between the lines. And he had to give the order to have him shot. Because he'd obviously seen where the British, position was, and he could give it away. He couldn't take the risk. And how this haunted him. You know, and a friend of my mother told me the story, which comes vividly in, which I wanted terribly to use and did use in Orders from Berlin, about during the bombing of London, how he found a hand sticking up out of the ground. I don't know if you've yet got to that in the book.
I think so, yeah.
A disembodied hand. The rest of the body is trapped under masonry, but the hand is still alive, and the policeman holds the hand until it goes cold and has this sense of contact with the person that they can neither see nor hear during that dying hour. And, you know, that was terribly vivid to me, and that's a real story. So, you know, the next door neighbor who lived next to me in my village when I was a kid had saved his friend at Dunkirk because his friend couldn't swim because the ships were big. That they had to swim out from the coast under bombardment with his friend on his back. You know, all these kind of things were very much part of my life growing up, and everything was very much in the shadow of the war when I was born. You know, rationing hadn't finished that long before. So it was very vivid to me and something that I wanted to, revisit.
I'm just absolutely fascinated with you and listening to these stories and things. And you're an absolutely fascinating man, and your book's interesting. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Well, so far, David, it's been fun. I've enjoyed talking to you.
We've been talking about Orders from Berlin, which you can get in all your bookstores now. It's from Minotaur Books, but Minotaur always has great books. I don't know what it is. They always find the most wonderful books. And we've been talking. And we've been talking to Simon Tolkien, and you can go out and get the book now from wherever you get it, ebook or whatever. Are they doing audio of it?
I don't know. They're doing an audio in the UK right now.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Which is going to be coming out, so I don't know whether the US will use the UK version. I don't know.
I wonder if we'll hear the bombs in the background.
Yeah, that would be good. It's HarperCollins in the UK, and they do a good job of that kind of thing.
Well,
I'm looking forward to that.
You do a great job writing, and I can't wait to see what you do next. Thank you so much for being on my show.
Thank you for having me on.
And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.